Hello and welcome to Failing Boldly, a podcast that invites people to share stories about failure, resilience, and perseverance. I'm Christian Kuhn, author of the book Failing Boldly and pastor of Urban Village Church in Chicago. My guest for this week's podcast is Matthew Vines, author of the book God and the Gay Christian and the founder and executive director of the Reformation Project. In 2012, Matthew delivered a speech at a church in his hometown of Wichita, Kansas, making the case that Christians should affirm gay Christians and their marriages. The speech went viral, having been seen now more than a million times. In 2013, Matthew launched the Reformation Project to equip and empower Christians to advocate for LGBTQ inclusion in their faith communities. Needless to say, Matthew is passionate about his mission, which I think definitely comes through in this conversation. I hope you enjoy it. Well, Matthew Vines, thank you so much for joining me on the Failing Boldly podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I usually ask folks to share just a little bit about your background. And so I was wondering if you could talk about how God and the Gay Christian came about, and then also if the Reformation Project came out of that or happened simultaneously, or how did you come to be who you are?
Ah, good question. I'll try to answer it briefly. First, they did kind of happen simultaneously, but the backstory to that is I'm 27 years old. I grew up in Wichita, Kansas, and in a conservative Presbyterian church of about 2,000 people, and in a Christian home where our faith was the most important thing that my parents wanted to share with my older sister and me. So I became a Christian at the age of 3. That's when I first asked Jesus into my heart. It's one of my very first memories. And then we were just very actively involved in our church as long before I was born, certainly, and as long as I can remember. My parents were both elders in the church. And for me, growing up, church was a very safe and supportive and nourishing place. And it was just really easy for me to want to be a Christian because I feel like my parents lived out their faith in with a lot of integrity and in ways that made it obvious to me that I wanted to live like that too. Mm. And it was clear to me how Jesus at the center of their lives and their relationship helped to make them kinder, more humble, more compassionate, self-giving, loving people. And that's what I wanted as well. So fast forward to high school. Then I went to college in 2008, and I went to Harvard for undergrad. By the time I went there, I'd met some openly gay people in my high school because I did theater, and most of them, who I met were theater kids. And I certainly felt somewhat uncomfortable with my church's teaching on the topic. Back from the first time that I even found out that gay people existed, it made me feel uncomfortable with my church's teaching. But it wasn't until my first year at college that then I was really agonizing over it much more. And I joined the only groups on campus that would not be supportive if I came out, which were like the InterVarsity group on campus. But ironically, that was actually the best community that I found my freshman year at school, because that was the place where I actually found a group of people who I felt like cared about me and to whom I was not invisible. And I think just as a quick aside, a lot of people wonder why would LGBTQ people want to be a part of conservative Christian communities? And, when they do all this harm to us. And unfortunately, it's just like, well, there are lots of really great things that you can find in those types of communities. And oftentimes, depending on where people are, that might be the only community that they've found that really cares about them as a person, which makes it more important to them to have a community that's affirming, and also makes it more devastating when the community is not. But so then by the end of my freshman year there, had really become passionate about this topic on a kind of impersonal level. I'd done, some Bible studies with some other members of the InterVarsity group who felt more like I did on it. But it wasn't till about 6 months after that, after I'd become passionate about it as an issue of justice and equality and human dignity and something that I think the church needed to change, that then I was finally able to ask whether or not that might have anything to do with me and with my life And that was, even though by this point I did not think there was anything wrong with being gay, I thought you could be gay and Christian. I didn't think that, you know, I didn't think that it was a sin. It was still a pretty devastating and terrifying realization, because I just had no idea how much of everything that was most important to me would still be there for me after that. So, you know, to go fast forward through a lot of unpleasantness, but eventually I went home that Christmas. I came out to my parents and I took a whole semester off school just to work through this conversation with them. They were both not at all ready or in a place where that was even something that had ever crossed their mind, that one of their children might be gay. But they're both really loving people. It was just a big paradigm shift that I was kind of forcing them to go through. So for my dad in particular, he was convinced that same-sex relationships were wrong and that you being gay was something that you could change if you tried hard enough. But this was part of the benefit of me staying home for a full 8 months. We would just get to talk about it and, you know, read books that he would find and read books that I would find. And eventually he read all our own church library's ex-gay books, which he thought were the answer at first. But then after reading the books themselves, he realized that they were not quite as, that the titles didn't necessarily match the content of the book, and that the stories of change and transformation were not really about sexual orientation change, but were about changing destructive patterns of behavior that may relate to sexuality and may only tangentially relate to sexuality, maybe primarily about other issues or drug addiction, you know, you name it. Unfortunately, issues that were not a part of my life. And so for him, he began to realize, okay, being gay, actually, that is a real thing. But then he was still very concerned about these, you know, the six references in scripture to same-sex behavior. But he still was willing to at least consider an alternative perspective if I presented one to him. So basically what ended up, I would say that why I'm focusing on this relationship with my dad and my parents is because that really, for me, has been the model of how change is possible, especially with more conservative Christians. It is true. There are some people, you could present the best argument in the world to them, and they're not in a place where they are willing or able to hear it. But I think there are plenty of people who, and plenty of Christian parents who come from non-affirming churches, are part of non-affirming churches, but when they have a child that comes out to them, it changes their heart and they want to become affirming, but their head still doesn't know how. And so they feel a great sense of conflict and tension. They want to be able to fully embrace and support their child, but everything they've ever been taught about how to interpret scripture on this topic doesn't let them see how that can be done. So what I think there's kind of a, there are a lot of people who what they kind of need two ingredients in order to really become affirming and vocal about that. One, they do need personal relationships or experiences that change their hearts and that in, you know, that cause them to at least think that this is something worth looking into more. But then they also need a theological understanding that works within the framework of the basic approach that they've always had to scripture. And by that, I don't necessarily mean, what I mean by that essentially is just an approach that doesn't disregard any biblical texts, that can't just say, oh, well, Paul said this, but Paul, you know, we're just going to put that on one side. I think for most Christians in the world, and certainly most conservative Christians, that is not a, that's a non-starter of an argument. And so you have to be able to present a compelling way of interpreting the texts that allows people to continue to uphold the authority of scripture while also giving them a way to look at this topic differently. So eventually, my dad and my parents did change their minds. Certainly for my dad, he did not expect to, but he ended up changing his mind. And then I worked to come out to a lot of people from our home church, which was a very emotionally excruciating process that I recommend, actually. And I'm not being sarcastic. It's not pleasant at all, but I do recommend that as much as people are able to, and people have various capacities to do this, and people need to know what they are capable of, but as much as people are able to, I do think it is very helpful that when we are coming out, we share our story with the people in our lives who know and who have known and loved us for our whole lives. Even if they're not going to respond the way that they should or the way that we want them to, you can still oftentimes, I mean, some people will respond horribly, but I think most people will respond somewhere else on the spectrum. It may not be what it should be, but like you can still plant seeds and change the way that people start to think about this, even if it takes years for them to really ultimately rethink. So eventually I did end up having to leave that church just because I'd hit a wall many times, but I tried to plant as many seeds as possible before I did. Then 5.5 years ago, I gave an hour-long speech on the subject of the Bible and same-sex relationships that then went viral and then led to me getting a book deal, which ultimately turned into God and the Gay Christian, and around the same time, starting the Reformation Project, because the two things that I felt were missing when I was coming out for me personally in my conservative evangelical church was having a clear, compelling biblical message that was tailored to people like my parents and to people like the people in my church I grew up with, a very particular way of approaching and thinking about biblical interpretation. But then two, I was also missing any kind of broader organizational backing or support to try to stick around and not just be tilting at windmills, but to try to stick around and actually be able to make some kind of progress in asking people to create more space for this conversation. So that's kind of the video that I did 5 years ago. The book that I wrote is kind of in the vein of creating and trying to present those resources to people who are in the shoes that I was in a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And the organization is dedicated to equipping and empowering people to not be just on an island, to actually be connected to a broader network of people, and ultimately to be creating the space for more and more people who are kind of silently sympathetic in churches to start to become more vocal, so that this becomes a less isolating experience and so that more change becomes possible.
Yeah.
Okay,
that's really helpful.
Kind of a long answer.
Yeah, but it kind of answered my question too, perhaps why, I mean, I'd read many books over the years and why God and the Great Christian seemed to go viral, both the book and the video, but I think you explained why. And I also loved, I watched the video of you at Google, and you're saying that one of the great things is if you can get somebody who considers themselves evangelical with a message they find life-changing and compelling, there's no better evangelist. And so once you, in a sense, get those people on your side, then you've got great messengers to go out and share that.
It's true. And honestly, so my church was an evangelical church, but we didn't really talk about it that way. There's so much debate around the term evangelical. I mean, it has so much baggage and all the, and people who walk away from it, leave it. I never felt a strong attachment to the term, but it's just because that wasn't the way that it was presented. It's not like it was taught, you are an evangelical. It's taught, no, you are a Christian. I didn't even realize that Christianity, right, contained more wings to it than just what our church represented.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about both, I guess, your own experience, and then I would imagine you've had countless conversations over the years with LGBTQ folks, particularly if they grew up in a more conservative Christian background, and that moment when they begin to come out to themselves, and at least the folks that I've talked to in my ministry, there's a sense of disappointment, a sense of that they're disappointing either God, or they're disappointing their parents, or they're disappointing the church. And so I'm wondering if you could just reflect a little bit both on your own experience of that, and I realize everyone has their own individual story, but if there are themes from all the stories that you've heard over the years that when people have that sense, there's a sense of I've somehow failed, something happened to me, and I don't want this. And so, reflect on that with me if you could.
Whew. Well, it's interesting. For me, when I was, I think everyone who grows up in an environment where being gay or bisexual or transgender is something that's not going to be received positively, then certainly I think almost everybody feels the weight that they will be disappointing people they love, mm-hmm. even though that's wildly unfair because right. you didn't do anything
right.
To disappoint people, but you still feel that weight. When it comes to the failure question, I think that I did not feel like I had, when I finally acknowledged to myself that I was gay, I didn't feel that I had failed because I knew that I didn't have any control over it, that it just was what it was mm-hmm. and that it was, you know, beyond my ability to do anything about. But I did feel for a time that I, you know, for reasons outside of my control, was kind of condemned to a, the phrase half-life is probably too dramatic, but condemned to just a lesser future and a future of questionable worth.
Mm-hmm.
And I ultimately, it was really helpful for me that I went away to college 1,600 miles away from where I grew up, because it gave me a lot more space to process. And also, I went away to college at the time in one of the two states that had same-sex marriage.
Hmm.
So, and where, you know, there were plenty of openly gay students on campus. It was not an issue. It was not a controversy. And so what was helpful for me was, I'm a pretty rational person, and, or at least that's how I kind of think through things. And ultimately, I just had to think through, even though I had already 6 months before thought through kind of all of the arguments against same-sex relationships and decided that I didn't think any of them were good, and I thought they were all bad arguments, then I still felt in my gut that this was an inferior life to lead. And I had to, I felt come rushing back all of the arguments and ideas that I had already thought through and decided were wrong, but I still felt them just kind of viscerally.
Sure.
And so what I had to do was just, I think I almost I logicked myself out of that feeling because I got to be in not even intentionally, I think I almost, there was a part of me that wanted to wallow in that feeling just because it's what I felt. And so I wanted it to be valid. I wanted my feelings to be valid, I guess. But living in a space where every day the kind of Wichita, Kansas reaction that I was having inside was shown to be baseless based on the actual lived experiences mm-hmm. of other people, seeing, look, you actually can be gay and be happy. You can be gay and be successful. You can be gay and be respected. You can be gay and do important things for your community. That's a message that you don't get growing up in a church like the one I grew up in, but that I actually would see the reality of every day, where I would just look around and then I would feel a little ridiculous for having the feelings that I was having, because I was like, you feel so convinced this is inferior, and yet you can look around and see evidence that it is not. And so I kind of had to just then, I worked through all the arguments once again. And finally, it required me being in that space. And that's part of the reason why I'm really passionate about trying to build bridges and trying to create change in non-affirming churches, because most LGBTQ kids growing up in a church like the one I did do not have the luxury of going away halfway across the country for college and having that kind of space to process and think through things and actually deconstruct all these toxic ideas that you've inherited. And it was hard enough for me with that luxury. Without it, I mean, it would have been a much slower and more painful process. And so I think it's important for those of us who are able to come to a place of greater self-acceptance to do what we can to advocate for and speak up for and create more space for those who don't have all those same opportunities and who are probably a little bit more crushed under the weight of those types of ideas.
Yeah. You talk about greater self-acceptance, and I'm wondering, as I was watching the video, the Google Talk video did still have the comments there. People can still make comments. And I can only imagine the criticism that you have received throughout the publishing of the book and the talk that was that went viral 5 years ago. So I'm wondering, how do you deal with the criticism? I would imagine if you allowed it, you could just go through all kinds of negative feedback every day. And so I'm wondering, A, how do you deal with the criticism? And B, does that criticism ever stick to you? Or are you at a point now where it just kind of bounces off?
Yeah, I'll be honest. I don't deal with it because I don't care. Mm. It doesn't bother me. It's unfortunate. You know, I wish that these attitudes didn't exist, but I'm well aware that they do. So I fully expected that kind of response when I started doing this. And to me, it's actually a sign of success because... And so I actually find a modest encouragement from it in the sense that, for instance, the day that my book came out back in 2014, you know, five Southern Baptist professors and theologians released a 100-page ebook rebuttal in emphatic language describing how wrong my argument was. And I found that to be incredibly encouraging because that meant that I had a voice. And I think that the most, for me, when I was trying to come out at my church, one of the most painful experiences was just feeling like my voice could be completely silenced. And if you are one person in a church of 2,000 and all the people in positions of power there, or just enough of them, really don't want you to have a voice, they can succeed, probably. And making sure that you don't. And I think that, you know, it's a lot of conservative churches do not want this conversation to ever get started because once it gets started, they see where it goes and it generally ends up in a more affirming place. So the best way to prevent your church from becoming affirming is to never allow any conversation to start about it. That's also a uniquely dehumanizing experience for those of us who are like desperate to have a conversation about this. So for me, the fact, I guess, because that's kind of where I started, was feeling like I had to struggle so hard to even be heard at all. That's why I find some modest encouragement from a mountain of negativity, because that's a sign that I'm being heard.
Yeah. And they're doing some marketing for you too, perhaps.
Well, I mean, I don't know if every, you know, YouTube commenter posting anti-gay.
No, but like, going back to the Southern Baptist.
Certainly. Yeah. But yeah, even people who write, it doesn't bother me because, I mean, obviously it's not the way that it should be, but it is the way that it is. And to me, I'd rather... It's just kind of a multi-step process. And if step one is being completely invisible and voiceless, and step two is, you know, gaining a voice but having a lot of people mad about it, I'd rather be at step two than step one.
Yeah. How have you handled it? You mentioned you're 27 and you are one of the real leading voices in the LGBTQ Christianity movement. Do you place or do you find that extra pressure has been placed on you, whether you put that on yourself or others have placed it on you? And if that's the case, then what's the process you go through? Maybe if you are speaking somewhere or doing an interview like this and you say something and you think, I wish I could have had that back, or I wish I wouldn't have said it quite that way. So I guess I'm going down the road of how do you respond when you feel like you have made a mistake or erred or failed in some way, especially with now with your heightened status.
Right. I mean, I definitely feel a sense of responsibility to the broader LGBTQ Christian community because we remain in so many places, you know, insufficiently heard or represented. And that means that for better or for worse, those of us who have more of a platform, the things that we do and say have a greater ability to shape perceptions of other people who are still, you know, struggling to be heard by their families, their friends, their pastors, you name it. So I think that absolutely comes with a responsibility to be really careful and thoughtful about the things that you say. So for me, honestly, I think I do most of that work at the beginning. I just try to be careful. Mm-hmm. And as a result, it's not that I've never said anything that I would have phrased differently, but generally generally it's been fairly minor things. And, I just try to, or, you know, if I say something that and I'm not, you know, I offend somebody, then obviously I feel badly about that. And I, you know, want to reach out to people and apologize and let them know, you know, that I'm sorry that I offended them. But I think, I mean, it's not that I never offend people, but I think just being really thoughtful and careful about it helps to minimize the situations that happens in. But I think also most people respond, certainly, I don't know, I feel like there is a lot of grace from people, certainly within like the LGBT Christian community itself. I feel like there's a lot of grace. And even if I ever do say something that, you know, strikes somebody the wrong way or offends somebody, I don't feel like people are ever, you know, out to get you or something. There's a shared, there are a lot of shared experiences and a lot of shared understandings of the things that all of us go through in various ways. So I think people respond well to, as long as they feel like you do care about them. And even if there are topics you might disagree on or approaches, tactics you might disagree on, I think as long as people feel heard and respected and valued, that generally goes a really long way.
Yeah. Yeah. I usually ask folks to share a failure story or two. So is there some time in your life where you attempted something that totally went awry?
I mean, yeah, the main thing is I really wanted to change the conversation at my church that I grew up in. And I felt like I completely failed. Because I knew that, you know, watching my dad, for instance, I know that there are many conservative Christians who oppose same-sex relationships, who oppose, you know, LGBTQ equality across the board, who are good, kind people with good motives and who could change their minds if they're engaged in the right way, relationally, scripturally, you know, with the right confluence of factors, are capable of changing their minds. And so I feel like you have to kind of have I have to have a default attitude of an assumption of good faith until proven otherwise in other people, because it will be proven otherwise on plenty of occasions, but there will be other times when people surprise you and when you might have been tempted to write them off, but you chose not to, and then they surprise you and turn out to have made your time worthwhile. So that's what I try to do. The problem, though, is, again, when your assumptions of good faith are disproven. And so for me, it's not that I'm saying that therefore, you know, the majority of people from my home church were not operating in good faith or something. I wouldn't say that. It's just a little more complicated because not everybody is in a place where they are ready to show you the compassion that you deserve. Not everybody is in a place where they're ready to exercise the empathy that they should. And to me, I think that a failure of compassion is far more of the problem than outright hatred in the church on this topic. Just a basic failure of compassion and a failure of empathy, a failure to fully put yourself in someone else's shoes and truly grapple with the weight of what you are putting on them and asking of them, to me is a much more pervasive and damaging problem than outright like malice toward LGBTQ people. Of course that exists and that's bad, but that malice gains so much more power because of all people who don't have any malice, but also don't have nearly enough compassion. So
does that failure, does that failure of empathy that you talk about, do you think people...
Well, that's a different kind of failure, I guess, than the one I was starting with.
But... Well, no, but I think it's an interesting concept. And I wonder, do you think it's because that would take a lot of internal work to engage in that? So do you think that people are afraid to begin that process because maybe they're afraid that they might change their mind? And if so, then that totally changes their worldview, which can be a pretty daunting thing. So I guess, what do you think contributes to that failure of empathy?
Yeah, a lot of things. Certainly changing your beliefs about an important moral topic is scary for most people. And it's even scarier when that would result in significant turbulence in your relationships, mm-hmm. In the communities that are most important to you. And it would raise questions for you about, you know, maybe how you're thinking about your church or your particular denomination and its tradition, or you know, the way that you've been taught to read things by other people. It's almost impossible to change your mind on this topic without it altering in some way your sense of trust and respect for the elders in your life who taught you a different way. Because this isn't a neutral topic. This is a very morally weighty topic, and it doesn't mean that you can't still have a respect for them, but once you come to a place where you recognize all these people who are very important to me, important elders, mentors in my life, were wrong about a vitally important question of morality and justice, that's going to do kind of a number on you. So there are a lot of things that I'm sympathetic to. The problem is that none of those things are more important than the actual devastation that continuing to uphold these beliefs is causing to people like me and to, well, everybody like who's gay or bisexual or transgender or queer in the church. So, well, I think I can have sympathy for that. At the same time, like, that doesn't mean that that's an okay place to land. So for me, I guess I was more optimistic than I maybe should have been about the ability of people at my church in general to really hear me out or to really have more of an open conversation about this. But I guess what I did in response to that was just change my timeline on how long it's going to take, because giving up, I don't see as an option unless you really think there is 0% chance that any individual in the entire non-affirming church will change their minds. If that were true, then giving up would be, you know, a sad but acceptable reality. And not that no one can give up, but I'm saying if you feel called to do this,
sure,
and if you feel like you have the capacity emotionally, spiritually, et cetera, to do this, then I don't think you should completely write off a whole mass of people. And, you know, when a number of those people actually can and will change, and you can help them to do that on a faster timeline. So for me, I then just, you know, just rededicated myself to doing this. Certainly, it was painful, and I wish that more people had been ready back then to have a more open conversation. But you know, I just try to focus on what I can control, and it's not everything.
Yeah. Can I ask, does your dad still go to the church?
No, my parents don't go there anymore. Okay. And that was really hard for both of them, because that had been such an integral part of both of their lives. But ultimately, I think it's hard for a lot of parents who do affirm their children once they come out not to feel some sense of betrayal from the community that baptized them and that pledged to be there for them, you know, for the rest of their lives, to nurture them, when that community then seems to turn its back on your child or to not really want your child anymore. And so that's a really painful thing. And again, that's not to say that they don't continue to have positive relationships and friendships with plenty of people from that church, because they do. But it's hard.
Yeah.
So that's that they go to a different church now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, for folks who live in the Chicago area, Matthew will be in Chicago when this comes out. You'll be here in 3 weeks for a conference for the Reformation Project. So, Matthew, do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yes. From October 26th through the 28th, the Reformation Project will be holding our annual national conference in Chicago at Fourth Presbyterian Church downtown. This is the fifth conference that we've done that's been open to the public, and we focus on training and equipping Christians who want to be able to be bridge builders and want to be helping to change hearts and minds of non-affirming Christians with the tools and the resources that they need to do that. We focus on theological training and equipping, but it also goes, it's broader than that. We also want to give people kind of a chance to refuel, mm-hmm. because there are a whole lot of reasons why people in our community and our allies can feel very weary and beaten down. And this year, that's more true than ever for a lot of us.
Yeah.
And it's not just the family rejection or church rejection that people experience. It's the just, you know, all of the really horrible things that
just a huge backlash after
indirectly.
Yeah.
And certainly after, mar the podcast by saying Donald Trump, but certainly, I mean, that's been a huge, spiritual, it's been really hard for a lot of people in terms of how it's alienated them from their churches too. Mm. And how it's made them feel less, you know, made them feel like their church is not what they thought it was, or, you know, was not actually as committed to the teachings of Jesus and how it was presented to them, and has other values and other commitments that are coming first. There are a whole host of reasons why people, especially in the LGBT Christian community, can feel really beaten down and tired. And so one of the goals of the conference is also just to refuel people.
Yeah.
And so we have, you know, Jarrell Wilson, who you know because he's been involved at Urban Village and was the resident. Wait, what was his official title?
Church planting resident. Jarrell would want us to make
church
sure we got
resident,
that.
Yeah. And who's an excellent preacher. He's going to be giving the opening keynote on Thursday, October 26th. And so the goal is also to have, you know, to have worship. Angie Hong from Willow Creek is going to be leading worship throughout the weekend. And it's always a pretty cool worship experience, because we'll have people from all over the country, from other countries, who come, and it's the first time that they've had the opportunity to worship God without feeling like without feeling like everybody was breathing down their neck and looking at them askance, and, you know, feeling as though they shouldn't actually be there, feeling as though they shouldn't actually be worshiping God with other people. So they're just, in terms of spiritual nourishment and inspiration and finding fuel for the journey, that's a big part of it as well. And then another big part of it is just making friends and connecting with other people who are in similar environments and who are trying to do similar things. It's really, really hard to do these things if you feel like you're the only person you know who's trying to do it. And so the more people you meet, the more friends that you make, it's just, that's another kind of critical support system. So we focus on all of that, on the theological training and teaching that people need to be more effective in their conversations with friends, pastors, family members, whoever it may be, who they're trying to help look at this differently. On basic, you know, spiritual nourishment and worship and inspiration, and then on making friends and getting to know people. And then also we have a whole range of really great workshops that go in deeper into specific topics that people might be wanting more insight or equipping around. So I would, everybody, people can register. You can actually register on site, but it's more helpful if people register online in advance. If you go to reformationproject.org/Chicago, we'll probably have about 400 people at the conference, and everyone is welcome. Even if it doesn't even matter. Yes, this is a conference that is an LGBTQ affirming conference, and that's obviously a big part of what we do, but it's open to anybody. You don't even have to be affirming. If you have a parent or a sibling who's not affirming, but they might be willing to listen, bring them along. Mm-hmm. Because we really want to be respectful and thoughtful and sensitive in how we talk about this. We're trying to build bridges. We're not just trying to, you know, lob rhetorical bombs at people and say, you know, shame on you. We really want to invite people to reconsider. So we always have some people who are not affirming there, typically who are brought along by friends. And so they're welcome too. You don't even have to be a Christian. I mean, obviously, yes, it's a Christian conference, and that's a big part of what we're talking about. But we always have people who are not Christian who come because they're interested. They want to learn more. And you are very welcome too, regardless of your faith, identity, or background or affiliation. So it's, you know, the heart of it is it's for LGBTQ affirming Christians who want to, you know, help make a change in any faith context that they're in where they'd like to see a change made. But it's open to everybody.
Yeah. Well, you've made that clear. So I'll put the link into my own Podbean page too and my website so folks can click on that if they want to learn more and register. I know a lot of folks at Urban Village are going to be there and are excited about going. Matthew, thank you so much for spending some time with me. I'm grateful for your witness, and you can go on any major bookseller to find his book, God and the Gay Christian, and go to reformationproject.org and learn more about him and about the conference coming up. So again, Matthew, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Christian. It's really been lovely to be here with you.
That's this week's episode. My thanks again to Matthew Vines for speaking with me. And you can learn more about him and the Reformation Project Conference in Chicago by going to reformationproject.org. I hope you will subscribe to this podcast, as my next conversation is with Wendy Snyder and Bill Leff, popular radio personalities on WGN Radio here in Chicago. To learn more about my book and the ministry I'm a part of, you can go to christiankuhn.com. Thanks again for listening.